Travelcast, episode 501. The Travelcast is an audio fiction podcast magazine that brings strange stories by strange authors to strange listeners such as yourself. I'm your host, Norm Sherman. On this week's show, we've got a paranormal murder mystery for you. Some things would be a lot easier if you were a ghost, there's no doubt. Seeing inside trees, for example, biting people in the arm, and solving murders. The downside, though, is death, which is a heavy price to pay to know what's going on in a sycamore. Nope. What you want to be able to do is communicate with ghosts, literally getting the best of both worlds, ours and whatever the f*** theirs is if they exist. Honestly, that's all I'd want to talk about if I was a medium. Who cares about reuniting loved ones with some deceased aunt? I'm going to ask your aunt what the f*** is going on over there. Your niece would like to know what year it is in ghost time and what system of governance holds your society together. What? I didn't ask that. She says she very much misses you and wants to know if there are any types of natural predators where you are, and if a million ghosts can stand in the same place. That's not what... I'm hearing your aunt tell you to shut up. Will you give us a sign if black holes are where you live? Knock once if black holes are ghost civilizations, and knock twice if tornadoes are when you guys fight. I want my money back. Shh, don't you want to know about black holes? My brother and I have a ghost pact. We've always said when one of us dies and they put that white sheet over us at the hospital to prep us for being a ghost, we have to, no matter what, no matter how impractical or inconvenient it is, we have to, because of the ghost pact, make the best possible attempt we can, under the conditions, to haunt the other one. Ideally, to give the other one a heads up as to what to expect or what to bring, so we're not just walking into the afterlife, if there is one, totally blind. And you know who else did this too, but for a totally different reason than in case there were natural predators of some sort. Harry Houdini. In his final years, Houdini hung up his big, tall magician hat full of rabbits for another cause, debunking fake psychics. His passion for magical tomfoolery gave him a unique perspective on those who claimed otherworldly abilities, and as a master of illusion, he knew how to draw out and spot a fake. The great escape artist's war on mediums even reached the United States House of Representatives in 1926, when he spent 4 days testifying before Congress to pass House Resolution 8989, a bill that would have made fortune-telling illegal in Washington, D.C. At this time, you gotta remember, there was a growing concern among skeptics that top-level members of the U.S. government were consulting with psychics and fortune-tellers. And this was not an unfounded fear, either. Several members of Congress and even Florence Harding, First Lady to President Warren Harding, had been known to meet with mediums. The idea that critical decisions could be influenced by psychic powers was a reasonably terrifying premise. But despite the magician's earnest efforts to show that psychics were frauds, and much like current-day insider trading reform measures, the resolution failed to pass, because the act of predicting the future was seen as a religious practice. Houdini died on Halloween 1926, the same year as the battle for House Resolution 8989, and as one last act of debunking the spiritualists, Houdini wanted to prove that seances were fake and mediums could not contact the dead. So he promised his wife Bess that if somehow he could communicate with her after he died, absolutely nothing would prevent him from trying for as long as it took him. Bess Houdini held seances for 10 years after his death, until she herself died, and each seance produced the same thing. Nothing. But since then, others have picked up the torch of attempting to contact the late escape artist. A real thing called the annual official Houdini seance takes place each year in Appleton, Wisconsin on Halloween. And none of these seances have ever been able to establish communication with Houdini to ask about tornadoes. Perhaps they aren't being clear on what specific object to knock. Perhaps Houdini's just waiting for the right opportunity. Or maybe, just maybe, he really did debunk the act of the seance. Or maybe he just hasn't figured out how to get replies past the event horizon yet. If anyone will be able to figure that one out, though, it'll be the world's greatest escape artist. And with that, we bring you this week's story, Pastoral, by Cormac Baldwin and E.V. Smith. Cormac Baldwin and E.V. Smith are a daring duo of authors and editors. Together, they run Archive of the Odd, a found fiction press. Apart, they've done jobs such as working in an abandoned lighthouse grinding up fish to feed other fish, and succumbing to madness among impossible maps. They went to the coast recently. It was nice. You should see it. And so without further ado, we bring you Pastoral by Cormac Baldwin and E.V. Smith. It was supposed to be a perfect vacation. No, it was going to be a perfect vacation. Horatio had peered into every future he could see long enough to understand, and there he had found rolling hills and whispering waves. For him, it would be a break from the city, with its fates and possibilities tangled into a single pulsating knot. For David, a break from the bereaved's requests for the passage of their troublesome loved ones. They would not be a minor seer and psychopomp, but tourists. There would be sweet country air mixed with the salt tang of the ocean. There would be a seaside cottage painted in pastels. "There's a body in the pipe organ," David informed Horatio matter-of-factly, not 10 minutes after they entered the Stone Cathedral, the first stop on their itinerary. Perhaps it was his fault for bringing a psychopomp on vacation. The thought of skeletal remains sandwiched between oak and ivory made Horatio queasy.
"Ugh, they used to do that, I think. Churches and such."
David's lips pressed into a half-frown as he walked over to the behemoth structure, so large it forced the pews to crowd together like teeth in a too small mouth.
"No, this is recent. They're not at peace at all."
Horatio swallowed. Flickers of darkest night entered the static of futures. He opened his mouth to ask 1,000 questions at once. "Can you see them? Why would they be in the pipe organ, not the walls? How recent? Last century or last week? Do we have to do anything about that?" He rubbed his eyes, forcing away charcoals and red that crept like disembodied veins into his vision, as well as the dread swirling in his stomach. There were good futures yet. Shepherds with little yarn shops. Seaside toffee, the kind with chunks of salt. Nice things. Things that did not include bodies and instruments.
"Is this something you'd like to focus on?"
He needn't have asked. David was already lifting away the outer panel of the pipe organ, its designer evidently not having thought to install screws to protect entombed corpses.
"What are you doing?"
Horatio protested as David leaned the panel up against a wall.
"I'm a mortician. It's my duty," David replied. "And I'm a bookkeeper. That doesn't mean..."
he began, but the words dried up in his throat. There, and in the framework of futures, was a body. Fresh, rotting, leathery, skeletal. 1,000 ways at 1,000 points of discovery. White, at least for now. Dark hair, younger than not. And very, very dead.
"Oh, dear Lord."
David agreed. He traced a finger down the body's unbuttoned dress shirt, clean of blood, before hooking a finger around the middle hem. Initially, Horatio thought he was just pulling the shirt aside. Instead, the cavity of the man's stomach gaped back at him. Red slick glistened over the bump of vertebrae. A suggestion to call the police was abandoned before he could even attempt it. The odds of anything good coming out of the authorities seeing a black man and a Filipino man standing over a body after vandalizing a church were astronomically low. At least David assisted in murder investigations for his work, though usually at the behest of his partner, Richard. No amount of rationalization would make him feel better. Bucolic futures fizzled and popped out of existence, consigned to pastel flickers and a world of stone and somber faces. And that was before David started speaking to the empty air.
Hello?
My name is David. The mortician removed his hand from the man's empty abdomen and gestured a gore-streaked finger towards Horatio.
This is Horatio, a friend of mine.
After a moment, David turned and said,
His name is Andrew Germeyer. He was an architect.
Pleasure. Horatio lied. No, he oughtn't be rude. Not the man's fault he'd been murdered. I'm sorry to hear what happened to you. For a moment, they waited in silence. Then David shook his head. I'm afraid he doesn't know what happened to him. The last thing he remembers is putting on the kettle at home. To the air, he said, even in non-traumatic deaths, the endings frequently aren't easily accessible. Nothing to worry about.
It seemed rational for one to worry about the fact that his guts resembled a poor man's wallet, and evidently, Andrew agreed.
Would telling the minister help you move on? David asked.
Pause.
If you'd prefer to find out what happened, it may be more prudent to go to the police. Alternatively, I know a fine private detective.
A frown, perhaps at having the extolling of his boyfriend's values cut short.
All right. Do you know where I might find him?
It was not the manner in which Horatio had expected to take tea in a seaside cottage, but the minister's wife, Julia, was polite enough to provide it with a platter of biscuits. Horatio watched her throughout the futures, murmuring, crying, excusing herself to other rooms as he took tentative sips. Knowing that it was not poisoned did not make him feel better.
Oh, everyone loved Andrew, Julia said after David explained their visit. He only moved here a few years ago, but he's really made himself at home.
How wonderful, Horatio said.
He died last night, David said. Do you know of anything that could have been happening then? She considered it for a moment, then shook her head. Well, I was home with the children. Gerald, my husband, was running a community meeting at the pub until nearly 10. Much of the town would have been there, I imagine. We're tight-knit around here. Dozens of faces ticked by in the back of Horatio's mind, each giving the same alibi. Everyone had seen each other, and none of them had done it. He nodded, and David gave a short sigh. Would anyone else have access to the cathedral? David asked. Julia shook her head, eyes trained on the floor. Horatio drowned his burgeoning headache with a swallow of tea. This wasn't going anywhere, not that he could see. Future alibis paraded by his vision, each as steady as the last. Well, we would hate to keep you, ma'am. Thank you for your hospitality. Would it be possible for us to speak to your husband? She worried the hem of her shirt as possible versions of her stammered apologies or ushered them out the door. Well, he'll be at church today and probably won't be home until evening. David perked up at that, and the babble of voices cleared like a radio being tuned through static. A chorus of tips, threats, and excuses. 100 faces, suspicious and welcoming in turn. A future of interviews in between slammed doors. People talking, talking, saying,
Well, I was at the town meeting. Anyone can tell you that.
Well, who the hell are you? Don't look like any constables I've ever seen. Get the hell out of here before I... One step more and I shoot. Try me. Try.
Nothing he wanted to hear. Thank you, he interrupted before David could speak. But I'm sure we can find it if we need to. We only came because we thought the minister ought to know. Her frown deepened, but she accepted effusive thanks for the hospitality and walked them both to the door. It was not a triumphant return to the hotel, though Horatio had assured David that it was an opportunity to strategize and not just a rest on his headache. He'd explained what he'd seen from the chance of them asking around, leaving out the death threats. Nothing of use, David sighed. You said they'll all have alibis? Horatio nodded. It was mostly true. Everyone gave alibis, but everyone also confessed. If there was a killer among them, and he had it on good evidence that one did not lose their organs by accident, they wouldn't confess any easier than someone bullied into making it up. This may be beyond our skill sets, he said. Somewhere, in some future, the shutters kept flapping open and shut on a deathly dry wind. It was as Horatio peered into that orange haze that David announced, I'm going to call Richard. The future scrambled to keep up with the decision, sparking randomly between shores, fields, and returns to the city, and dry air, dead earth, and mocking clouds. I don't think that's... he started, but the word seemed to stick in his throat. The static of the future washed over his vision like a television whose antenna had been knocked askew. Blacks, reds, oranges, empty whites, screams, sighs of wind, nothing at all. Richard's voice, tinny from the connection, cut through the wall of noise out of sheer improbability. David must have already called. Hadn't it only been a second? Time wasn't acting right. Desolate air, burning sun. Everything is dry, dry, dry. Fire on the vortex of clouds. Clockwise, clockwise, switch, turn, turn, churn, and...
Are you sure?
Static turned Richard's voice to a mumble. A cough cleared it again.
Well, if I were you, I would look into the minister. He's the hinge in the alibis, isn't he?
Oh, good point, love. He wasn't available earlier, but...
It's all falling. It's all falling. It's all falling. A hand on his shoulder. Are you all right? David's voice was an anchor in a stormy sea. Here was where a Poirot, a Sherlock, someone other than a bookkeeper with a tendency towards prophecy, would say something to set the whole timeline right. Phosphenes of lush green and turquoise meant it wasn't a given. Not yet. He could unwind the machine and pull out the key, let David give up so naturally he wouldn't even notice. The best he got was, I need air.
Of course. We can go back down to the shore for a bit. How about that? After that, Richard suggested going back to the church.
Horatio mentally threw out the last sentence. The thought of the gentle roll of waves soothed his burning mind. He nodded. The sky flickered between blues and blacks, reds and yellows, as they walked. Horatio squeezed his eyes shut to keep the shifting ground from tricking him into tripping, but broken promise, broken bones, break the city, broken tone. The smell of the ocean was what caught him first, the tang of salt mixed with the rich scent of decay. A breeze played across his face, depositing grit that wouldn't come out for another too many showers. Slowly he opened one eye, then the other. Teal water lapped at the sand, rolling tiny white stones into oblivion. Even in his double, tripled vision, a single boat bobbed peacefully along in the placid water. Through the window, he could make out moving shapes. Fishermen, or
Red sky in the morning, black clouds bring no rain. Run from what has waited on the shore, not sleeping, not fearing. Run, for the deal is broken. Breathe in the musk of rot, the only thing that will be left of you when it is done. Gaping silver faces, eyes twitching awake, as white mold turns scales to fur. Look ahead, see what the vengeful sea is offered. Colossus and yielding flesh, its tentacles reach far into the horizon. The squid roils with death. Darkened veins paint its endless arms and hit you, that smell, that awful smell, not its death alone. Horatio dropped to his knees and vomited. The hungry sand drank the bile all at once, or perhaps not at all, perhaps never again. Because it's coming. It's coming. It's coming. The brief peace of sleep was interrupted by his senses coming on, one by one, as if each had to be checked before continuing. Vision, showing speckles of red sky and falling fish, but mostly a tin ceiling that swung back and forth. Smell, salty but not infernal. Taste, rancid. Hearing, he wasn't sure. The futures had retreated, only babbling in the background, but he couldn't make out a single word of the overlapping voices of the present. Maybe he'd suffered some sort of brain damage, and that was why he'd fainted. Just his luck.
You're awake. How are you feeling?
David's voice, his face surrounded by echoes of the future, appeared above him. Horatio blinked up at him, as well as the repeated versions of him. Where am I? He asked. Another face, sea-worn and curious, entered his vision. David continued without noting the woman.
Fishing boat. These ladies saw you and offered to help. Horatio, this is Celeste, Tess, and Rosa.
He pointed at each, though only Tess was visible to wave.
Aunties, this is Horatio, as I said.
One too many?
Tess asked. The aunties behind her chuckled, and she cut them a glare. No, we were going to... The memories kept slipping away. He wasn't making his denial sound more plausible. We were going to the bait shop. That felt right. It stood in the future, hooks and leads rusted, beaten by the unforgiving sun.
Oh, the bait and tackle?
One of the aunties, perhaps Celeste, chimed in.
That place is fantastic. Gives us free bait when they have extra.
Nothing much, just some chum each summer to welcome us back. But better than buying, huh? Pink and red wiggled across Horatio's vision. He couldn't recognize anything from the flashes, but the mixed dread and nausea told him that it was something important. Bracing himself, he asked, do you have some now? Celeste scrutinized him, clearly wondering what sort of man woke up from a bender to ask about fishing.
Just got it yesterday. You'll need to pay if you want any, though.
Here. She shuffled out of sight, then returned with a cooler as large as her torso. With a flourish, she lifted the lid. Had anything been left in Horatio's stomach, it certainly would have come up then. The smell, gamey and rank, filled the microscopic cabin as a wave of red skies filled Horatio's vision. Even unflappable David gave a short at the bed of off-pink paste, slippery chunks of intestine surfacing like fish. On top, like a garnish, lay a heart the size of a fist. Horatio slid off the bed, catching himself on the railing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you mind if I talk to my friend alone for a minute? He asked.
You can go to the deck, Rosa said.
Thanks.
Horatio ran his hand along the wall until he reached the door, then shouldered it open. David had to duck to make it through. After easing it shut behind him, he turned back to Horatio.
Well, either the bait and tackle doesn't know or they're in on it as well.
Sealed storm shutters flaking paint and rusted iron bolts snapped shut, the thud of David's solid body on a steel floor that won't budge. By the time we get there, the shop will be closed, he warned. What do you suppose we do now, then? David's somber expression and silver hair matched the gray sea around them, the crests of sloshing white.
I'm a mortician. I need to return what's left to Andrew.
And so, with David 50 pence lighter, Horatio found himself holding an ice chest on the threshold of a pipe organ.
It's not much, but hopefully you'll feel a little more whole, David was explaining to the air.
Horatio turned his back. Even then, there was no escape from the slick sound of blood, flashes of red streaking David's fingers. The noise's abrupt stop was not the relief it should have been.
That's interesting, David said slowly. How do you suppose this got here?
Horatio could neither offer nor hear a response.
What did you find? Horatio asked as they walked back to the hotel.
The light rain that had started up interspersed with flashes of deep, viscous red. He didn't really want to know.
David ignored the question. He remembered something. He told me that the day he was taken from this world, the good minister came to visit him. To convince him not to attend the next community meeting, he would be the only one not in attendance. Carnage solidified in the writhing futures. Horatio could see it now. The two of them marched down at gunpoint past the rivers of fish, a mob of villagers at their back. Everyone is in on it then, Horatio said. A laugh bubbled out of his throat as the realization hit him, along with the rain of rotting fish in his nostrils. What, are we going to get the whole town arrested? Or do you want to be the one in that cooler?
Well, they can't kill me. You're the only one who really needs to be concerned, David said.
Horatio slapped a hand to his face, the sting briefly chasing away the encroaching desolation.
Oh, even better. Is that why you won't let what needs to be, be?
It's what's right, David said. Horatio's blood threatened to a boil. What's right is going to get us killed. Oh, I'm sorry, it's going to get me killed. Let me not rope you into this.
He hated himself for the hurt on David's face. He hated himself for being here. He hated that somehow in there, he still wanted to grasp for something beautiful and hold it tight. A turquoise sea, an ice cream melting onto white sand. Tears threatened to spill over his cheeks and join the sea.
David, I brought you along because I thought we could both use a break. A week with no more death, no more calamity.
David bit his lip, eyes scanning the horizon for bobbing boats and open ocean. He watched a lemon-yellow trawler putter out into the setting sun as Horatio watched it sink.
There's no getting away from it, he said finally, certainty exchanged for resignation.
I realize this isn't what you wanted, but this is what we do. People die everywhere. The future goes on everywhere. We make the best of what we can't control.
The boat rose again, pulled by a phantom hook, waiting for something that had never happened. It was dark when the minister, an aging man with a hen-dog expression Horatio suspected was permanent, came out to where they waited on the whitewashed porch. The comforting hum of charming, consistent life in the little town had sputtered and suffocated into quiet that unnerved Horatio more than any storm.
"And how can I help you, boys?" came his weary baritone as he eyed Horatio carefully.
Horatio tried to make himself smaller, never mind that he was nearly 32 years old.
David gave a tight smile.
"I'm sorry to interrupt your evening. I spoke to your wife earlier."
"Ah, yes. Thank you for alerting me to the situation. It's a terrible business. Lord help us."
The minister bowed his head in respect.
"I just have a few questions, if that would be all right,"
David pushed. He didn't give the minister a chance to refuse.
"There was a community meeting last night."
The minister cleared his throat with more force than necessary.
"Well, yes, it ran late. Lots of business to address, you know. New construction."
David narrowed his eyes.
"Without your architect,
perhaps you came by his house, told him to stay home." The minister schooled his terror behind an awkward smile that made no attempt to reach his eyes.
"I'm sorry?"
"And perhaps you came back, with all the people in this town lying on your behalf. Perhaps you killed him and shoved him in the area where no one but you would have recent access for a while."
David continued, ignorant or disinterested in how Horatio's stomach dropped further with every syllable. The minister sputtered, then straightened, anger growing in the place of his fear.
"Now you listen here, you filthy. I don't actually need you to tell me why I found this on the body. In fact, you may want to save that speech for the authorities."
In his palm, he clutched the black scrap of priest's chasuble for all to see. The low light had him looking like the corpse he swore to serve.
"I just need to know who exactly did it, and why. Why was there a man in the pipe organ diced up to be dumped into the sea?"
The minister withered, giving a small cough.
"Not dumped," he replied primly.
"Given. The ritual requires entrails to be sacrificed into the water. The organ was just a convenient place to storm away from any scavengers until the tides couldn't carry the corpse into trawler nets."
Horatio blinked.
"The ritual?"
Images of hands raised in worship clicked into place.
"Our town serves the ocean," the minister said. "It has for centuries, if not longer. Each year we find someone who does not know its glory and we give them as a gift. You must understand. We do what we must to receive its blessing. If we don't..."
His voice broke, the last of his resolve shattering into terror.
"Without seas, no one comes. Without fish, we cannot eat. Either they die or we all do."
He turned imploringly to Horatio, tears streaking down his cheeks. Horatio hesitated,
Through the swarm of rot and destruction, he could still do the math well enough. No easy answer anywhere in the crashing wave of reality. There was no killing it or sating it. One person a year ad infinitum. Or the town, the country, expanding out and out and... He bit back the wave of futures. Reluctantly, he nodded. There was holding it back, whatever it is. If there was a solution, it didn't show itself anytime soon. One did not argue with elder gods.
You give them no rights, David snapped.
Their right is honor our god, the minister ground out.
You've taken their life. You have no right to their afterlife as well. We have enough evidence to—
Let it break. Let it grow. Let it come from the sea. Years of placation will never make up for an eternity of want. The contract is broken. The deal is—
How about a compromise? Horatio suggested. The others stared. He continued as if his voice wasn't shaking. I mean, your town knows what they're holding back, correct? The minister paused, but eventually agreed. They're aware. They do their duty to help each year.
They sacrifice one of them. Someone who knows what's coming and who will want to save the people they care about.
The words turned into ash in his mouth as green and blue spread across the futures. Offer them the rights they deserve. Let them move on. If you can promise that, we'll leave on the first train tomorrow morning. He looked between the two. Do we have a deal? Horatio wished he could take comfort watching fields of snowy white sheep roll by the train windows. David had almost said the words so many times that they felt familiar by the time he finally asked, Did we even do anything? Somewhere, never far enough away, there remained a town that would slit someone else's belly the next year. In another year's time, they would gut one another, organs spilling out in halos before being fed to the gulls. Burials, cremation, funerals. It didn't change that moment where someone went from an end to a means. But the red had receded. Veins of annihilation no longer crept into visions of family asking how his vacation went. As pastel pastorals passed by, he said, No, I don't think we did. And that was our story. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did and want to show us your thanks, consider supporting us at our Patreon, patreon.com/travelcast. Get rewards, get connected, get weird. Special thanks to our awesome episode artist this week, Shane Bevan. Shane's a full-time lecturer in digital media, and his day-to-day job involves, well, making stuff work and teaching others how to make stuff work. He's also an awesome sculptor and artist of monsters. Check him out on Instagram at Shane Bevan. Our program this week was brought to you by Nicole Leitner, Beau Kier, Jossie Gerwig, John Gentry, Wyatt Scott, Joe Petrus, a million ghosts standing in the same place, Bart Epstein, Piper Lauderdale, Anya Rose, Maya Lovett, Demaeus Bloom, Lucas Stroff, and yours truly, Norm Sherman, reminding you to let it break, let it grow, let it come from the gosh darn sea, y'all.